And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. To Australia.
Hello, Dean Haglund. How are you?
Hello, Phil Lairness. Excellent. How are you?
It seems so recent that I spoke with you.
Just like it was 5 minutes ago.
5 minutes and one delicious salad ago.
Anyway, wow.
Yes.
You downed a salad in that time?
Oh, I did. We are pre-recorded this week, but what a fun pre-record, one that I've really been looking forward to. I had the idea, as expressed on this show, that this list that we're going to discuss would be something that maybe we would examine piece by piece on a week or every other week basis. But that's almost impossible. What with all the celebrities that die on a regular basis and all the other international brouhaha that we have to cover on your Chilpack
yes.
Hollywood Hour. So why not make a whole theme episode dedicated to looking at the British Film Institute list of the 50 films you should see by the age of 14? And,
yes.
And we both kind of loved the idea behind this list, which was that at a time of, splintering demographics and audience sizes and changing viewing habits, that it's really important
right.
to introduce to young people, and honestly, maybe their parents and their educators, the idea that cinema itself is an important cultural art form with important ramifications. And so this was a list that was created not only for young people to see, but with the encouragement that young people's parents and or their educators might watch it with them. So,
right.
As we've discussed in weeks past, the list is chronological, and it tries to be representative of each decade and each era in filmmaking, and attempts
right.
to be international as well, and all genres represented. The earliest film on the list was 1902's A Trip to the Moon.
Right.
The one silent feature that's on the list. And I do think they give silent features short shrift.
I agree. But you do have 100 years of cinema to get through in 50 films.
But one would think that with, as we've talked about before, the visual storytelling of the media having been perfected in the 1920s by silent filmmakers inventing the language, that it might have been well served to show some young people some of those works, whether they're Potemkin, I don't know. Whether it's
right.
an expressionistic horror film, I don't know. But, when we do our list, we'll add a couple for the kids to see.
Absolutely.
But the one...
I know there's always fear of showing kids silent films because they're going to think this is dull and boring and old-fashioned. And so sometimes they need to see what filmmaking is today, they then appreciate the roots of it,
yeah.
as it were.
And then go back. You're right. Maybe it's something you come to later. Certainly I did. I've only been educating myself on silent film over the last, since starting this podcast, because you are a shadowy influence upon me.
Well, that's a scary thought, too.
The one silent feature was the kid, Charlie Chaplin. I expressed at surprise when we talked about this before that that was the Chaplin film that was included and not one of what I think we could call one of his greater masterpieces. But you helped me see my way clear to understanding why this would be a good introduction for younger folks to see. So then we get into the 1930s, and you have King Kong of the first entry of the 30s, 1933. So what is it, do you think, that we're introducing 14-year-olds or younger, the young people, to with King Kong?
Well, you're exciting storytelling. Stop, period, full stop. I mean, in terms of just laying it out of a story of a giant ape on an island, that movie has no fat on it whatsoever. There isn't a single scene that is unnecessary. There isn't a single piece of camera work that doesn't add or heighten to the storytelling and the tension and the excitement. That still, here you are, almost 90-some-odd years later, and that 1933 King Kong is as exciting. It's more exciting than the remake, for sure, or all the subsequent remakes, but it's also such a tight movie that you should see it just for its sheer taking your breath away in the speed at which it moves.
And what do you think the film has to say thematically that might be important? I mean, I don't know how much we should get into this. We do have a lot of movies to get to, but
right. I'm not sure thematically. I mean, environmentalism, beauty killed the beast, may not be the best moral that you take away from it at the end. Was it beauty that killed the beast, or was it a bunch of greedy entrepreneurs that wanted to, you know?
It is an interesting film post stock market collapse, isn't it? I mean, about the greed, the corporate greed,
Yeah, making him the eighth wonder of the world and all of that marketing hoopla. That's sort of the second half. It's sort of a movie in two parts, really. And it's funny that the protagonist misses the point of the movie itself.
There is an element of it that I think is really important to introduce to young people, especially if you're showing them these films chronologically again, which is something that gets expressed in a quote from one of my favorite films of the 80s. By filmmaker Noah Cross, played by Peter O'Toole in The Stuntman, a movie that's all about illusion versus reality. And he asks at one point, do you know that King Kong the First, because the remake, the 77 remake, had come out shortly before they filmed this. Do you know that King Kong the First was just 3'6" tall? He only came up to Fay Wray's belly button. If God could do the tricks that we can do, he'd be a happy man. And I think
that's true. I mean, that's the genius of the stop motion animator Ray Harryhausen, right? He single handedly moved that. I mean, it was just clay on wire infrastructure, and how lifelike, how thoughtful the battle sequences are. I mean, it is quite a phenomenal technical science fiction, I guess, technically, science fiction special effects-laden film.
So then we move to 1937. There's two films in 37. Let's start with The Marx Brothers and A Day at the Races. Why, Dean Haglund, is this the right Marx Brothers movie to introduce to young people? And if you have an and why would it not be the right one?
Well, I suppose that you're thinking it's the right one because it has all the trademark gags. Their characters are as highly defined as they ever were. Groucho is Groucho. Harpo's got all his standard gags with the horns and the hand and the thigh and all of that. And Chico is on point with his piano playing, as is Harpo playing the harp, and all of that. However, I think going back just one movie, which is Night at the Opera, which is the one that I often, as I've said on the show, they had rehearsed live on stage, has much more, while fragmented, has many funnier gags. The stateroom scene, for instance, has much more levity, light, fast pace. They know the comic beats. They know the timing. Whereas Day at the Races, there is clearly stage actors who are now lost in movie roles that they don't exactly know exactly where the laughs are, I think.
I'm gonna say I think the classical music and the opera is maybe the point where they said, maybe not for the kids. Maybe not. The music and the music scenes are so much more accessible, I think, for younger people in Day at the Races. Not the least of which is the closing, where Harpo literally is the Pied Piper to a group of children. I think that scene is a big impact as to why maybe for children. I also think that the bits, the comedy bits that are just the Marx Brothers alone, are you know, of themselves so illustrative of who they are. But I do think that that ending with Harpo had no small role to play in why they probably picked Day at the Races.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I'm saying you're right. If it's younger than 14, if you're around 10, I suppose Day at the Races holds up. But if you're in your burgeoning teens, I'd say switch over to Night at the Opera.
So also in 1937, Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Why are we showing that to young people? Introducing the entire genre of animation through Snow White and the Seven
animation.
Dwarfs.
Animation. Well, think, yes. I mean, this is epic in that this launched Disney for every kid who sings Let It Go, bring him back to Hi Ho, Hi Ho, right? Those are the hit songs the kids were singing 90 years ago. How long ago was that now? And this is where Disney put it all on the line. He mortgaged his house for this movie. They slaved away in that little place off of Las Feliz, putting this together. This was a big risk, a massive gamble. No one had ever done a feature-length animated film before. No one would think anyone would sit through it. They thought animation was for kids. How could you tell any other story? I think still it holds up because of its thoughtfulness, because of its embracing. You know, talk about a guy who embraces the genre. This is taking that genre to a new level. And because kids love Disney, it still holds up. So it's a perfect film to see before you're 14.
It really is also the beauty of the painted cell, right? I mean,
yeah. Yeah, the craft, the art of itself.
Painted by hand. It's really a demonstration of that art form. Adventures. And it also is a very dark film. It's a dark film, and it's something that gets lost altogether too often, which is that children, you know, we live in this modern age where things can't be too dark if they're for kids. And yet,
right.
These fairy tales that so many classic stories are based on or adaptations of, they were really dark. And
yeah.
They serve a function, which is to psychologically prepare children for the darkness that life on planet Earth does involve from time to time. And introducing dark themes in a way that an evolving psyche can make sense of. That's why these stories have endured through the centuries. So I think that's another reason why that one in particular. 1938, The Adventures of Robin Hood. Now,
oh yeah,
I would start, I guess, with my observation that this is the first one on the list, unless you count Snow White. But it's an adaptation, a direct adaptation of literature, and it's an adaptation of literature that probably many of these young people, less than 14, have been assigned to read at one point or another in school.
Right. Yeah.
But that, and I guess the fact that 14 was the age of the average romantic partner for Errol Flynn are the only two reasons I can come up with why this would be on this list. What do you got?
Well, no, it's a swashbuckler. I mean, it's a story of robbing from the rich and giving to the poor. This is elemental in storytelling, and I think it's something kids can relate to from such a young age. And the way Errol Flynn's personal life aside plays this with such breeze and such joie de vivre that it is a revelation, particularly if you've been watching, serious acting, to see this guy basically traipse through and carry an entire feature film on his shoulders. It is kind of a remarkable performance.
Don't kid yourself, though. When we do our 20th anniversary show and clips are culled together from the previous decade, my line about Errol Flynn may make the cut. but also, of course, this is a British Film Institute list. And is there a more beloved, figure in their folklore than, as you said, Robin Hood. Robin,
right.
From the rich and giving to the poor at a time during worldwide depression. Also, Errol Flynn's, yep. Robin Hood. For my money, I always preferred Tyrone Power, Mark of Zorro. Always thought that was a better film. And in both cases, the villain was, the actor who played Sherlock Holmes.
Basil Rathbone.
Basil Rathbone, the villain in both of those. Yeah. But I always preferred. Totally. Did you ever see Mark of Zorro, the Tyrone Power?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and the swashbuckling fencing fighting scenes was very indicative of the time when actors trained as fencers. Like, that was an important part of your acting training, was to know how to sword fight. And you could see it in every frame of that movie, how both Basil Rathbone and were both well-versed in rapier and epee.
Yeah, although rapier and Errol Flynn are two words you don't want to... Anyway.
Okay, rapier is the name of the sword.
The Wizard of... I hope all children below 14 have been led away from the speakers at this point. 1939, Wizard of Oz. We close out the films that everyone should see by the age of 14 with The Wizard of Oz. This is kind of a no-brainer. I guess it's de rigueur. It's a rite of passage, is it not?
It is.
For people to see The Wizard of Oz. What do you think's important about it still,
well,
after all this
for young people
to see?
I remember seeing this as one of the first films I ever saw with, I remember parents dropping all four of us kids off at some movie theater to see this thing. And aside from the musical and the comedy and the color, black and white to color, there's also terror in this thing. The ticking clock that is the sand timer, with Dorothy trapped in the witch's castle and everybody taking the axe to the door, and the frame cutting, is just a simple editing process of cut to the ticking clock, the sand through the hourglass dripping, and everybody trying to break in to save Dorothy before I forget what doom it is. That was so tense and exciting to me as a small lad, that I would love for every child to experience that kind of terror in a movie that has a happy ending.
So much film language seems to trace back in some ways to Wizard of Oz, but so too is it one of the earliest exponents of dream language in film, real dream logic. The terror of this girl's coming of age story. There is a reading to be had that is indeed what it is all about. But certainly it deals with the concept of the psyche, of dream psychology, in a way that would influence so many filmmakers. I mean, kids, you're going to grow up someday and you're going to want to be able to expound and pontificate in brilliant terms about the works of David Lynch, but you're not going to be able to if you don't know Wizard of Oz.
Wow. Look at that, kids. That's coming from Uncle Phil right there.
So
oh my God.
We go to the 40s, and it's fascinating because there is no Citizen Kane. There is no Casablanca. You know, we're missing on this list so many of the greatest films ever made. The first film of the 1940s is one from Jean Cocteau, the last master of the Priory of Sion himself, poet and photographer, and brilliant filmmaker. I've always been a bit partial to his Orpheus, boy, The Beauty and the Beast is maybe one of the most beautiful, mesmerizing, and again, dreamlike films ever shot.
Yeah, and you know, I realize now I haven't seen this whole thing. I've seen clips from it. I've seen, you know, when you go through your Jean Cocteau documentaries where they show bits of it. So I feel like I'm well-versed in it, but realizing now, I've not seen this movie. How ashamed am I?
Well, you should be ashamed, I guess. But
I guess.
I don't know. I mean, it's never too late.
How will I find it?
Never too late to be 14, Dean.
Hey. Ain't that true?
Where do you find it? I mean, it's kind of a big deal, Beauty and the Beast.
Kind of a big
everywhere?
Deal, I know.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can find it everywhere.
Okay.
But indeed, I mean, it's Beauty and the Beast is so a cornerstone culturally everywhere around the world now, again, thanks to Disney. And why not see why and how this legend was translated to be resonant and relevant in the post-war Europe of 1946. Also in 1946, Frank Capra, It's a Wonderful Life. Now, this is a film that I did not come to until my middle ages of my 40s.
Well,
I
don't think anybody did, because this wasn't a big hit until they started showing it at Christmas holidays on television. And then it sort of developed into a cultural phenomena, which is surprising because it's a story that centers basically around a diverted suicide.
And yet, really, when it started being shown on television, and it could be discovered by the whole family, and lo and behold, maybe what they found is that this story really did resonate with younger people in a way that it might not have with some of us older folks, because it is a very inspiring, it's both a cautionary tale and it's an inspiring cautionary tale, right?
Absolutely.
Letting you know at the outset of your journey, before you put too much pressure on yourself, as long as your motivations are to touch people and to help people and to make a difference, you will do that.
Right. Yes. And answering the question, what is my place in the world? Which, again, is resonant with children, particularly as they come of age, that you ask that question. Would it matter? Do I make a difference? And how do I make a difference going forth in the world?
I remember I remember when I was young, this would be a little bit later, but certainly by late teens, you know, people that I grew up with would ask, will you remember me when you make it big? And a part of me was always screaming, well, will you remember me if I don't? You know, there was so much pressure. Like, you mean I have to do these things? Like, I have to do things. You know, that thought of having to achieve certain things or it isn't worth it is a huge pressure to put on young people. And this is a film that argues for the idea that decency always makes an impact. It's always felt.
Yes.
So that brings us to 1948's Oliver Twist. And I guess, again, this is, well, it's an introduction, obviously, of beloved piece Dickens. Of literature. It's, I think Dickens himself is entirely a cinematic genre as well as his own literary genre. It also introduces David Lean to film viewers, and there would be, again, arguably no more influential British filmmaker of the second half of the 20th century than David Lean. It's an introduction as... what's the character's name? It's the
Fagin.
Fagin, yeah, it's the introduction as Fagin by Alec Guinness, one of the great character actors of the century. So it really introduces a lot of special things to young people, and it is an enduring, timeless tale.
I agree. However, to me, this one, and I've seen it. And I guess you're not overloading the musicals. I always thought Oliver, the musical, was kind of a better film adaptation of Oliver Twist than the 1948 Oliver Twist. I know that's sacrilege, but side by side, I kind of enjoy the musical one better, just in terms of period detail, you know, of the steam trains of the time and the back alleys of the Whitechapel area and all that sort of thing. So I will argue point to its death.
Yeah, that's not bad, especially because, look, clearly this list, we're avoiding, quote-unquote, the greatest movies ever made. We don't have the best even of the Chaplins. We don't have even the best of the Marx Brothers. The issue is what might be the best to introduce young people, to make sure that they get it, that might whet their appetite. And so I could say that, Dean Haglund, you're probably right. Oliver makes more sense. The issue, I guess, is it's the 1960s, and are we waiting that long to introduce the musical genre to people?
Right.
Also, if we don't introduce Oliver Twist, where are they getting their Alec Guinness? Where are they getting their David Lean?
Right.
Because we're not showing them Bridge on the River Kwai.
I don't think... Lawrence of Arabia shows up, doesn't it?
No. So it becomes an interesting question. But when you see that one of the next films on the list is Singing in the Rain, and of course one would say, well, that is the greatest musical of all time. Of course we should show it to kids, but we're not showing them, according to this list, all the greatest films. We're showing them the ones that are great and artistic and a perfect introduction. And I'm not sure Singing in the Rain is the perfect introduction to musicals. It's a musical about musicals and about movies. I would question making that be the first musical on the list. Let them appreciate the musical form first before introducing the idea of commenting upon it. It would be equivalent to me of, well, we got to have a Western. I know how we introduce them to Westerns, Blazing Saddles.
Right. Or, yes, exactly. Or 1930 horror movies with Young Frankenstein.
And by the way, you will notice the very Britishness of this list. There are no Westerns, as far as I know, on this list. Certainly none of the ones during the golden age of Hollywood, right? So it might be interesting for us to submit our own list, do our own rewrite inspired by this, because there is, again, there is clearly and understandably... a British emphasis on this, a European emphasis on this. And indeed, hell, I don't know if you'd even find this list from any august body here in America, because we don't educate our children about any topic, let alone cinema.
Right. Fantastic point.
Not as good as my Errol Flynn line, but it'll do.
Are you really going to hang on to that?
So we've talked about Singing in the Rain. Let's back up to just finish off the 1940s with the Italian neorealist masterpiece, Bicycle Thieves. this is one of those cases where one of the great all-time films makes it onto this list, and I could not agree more. I honestly don't even know. I didn't see this until my early 20s, and I don't understand.
Somewhere in university.
Yeah, I don't understand how I grew up without seeing it, quite frankly.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I agree.
This thing is so heartbreaking. Movie. Yeah, it's so heartbreaking. No, has any film really before or since really that's about working class been more engrossing and heartbreaking than just this film that's a search for a bicycle? What could be more
that's
important to a child and to an adult who still has a child with, you know, within us?
Yeah, exactly. And how he has to run through all of Italy. And also, you know, you can point out that this is, again, post-war Europe, where the, oh my God, my Italian film studies, the cinema verte of the time, known as...
Neorealism,
yes, exactly. And that you could point out that this is an expression not just of the loss of a bicycle, but how deplorable the conditions were in post-World War II Europe, you know?
Well, and the idea of being able to actually shoot on location. So many of these films that we're talking about before, all of them maybe, if I look at this list closely again, all might in some way reveal the magic of movies.
Right.
Right? You know, King Kong, certainly, but even The Day at the Races, right? I mean, when it's clicking along, it's truly magical in the way it uses. You know, the Marx Brothers, in their films, they used cinema like magicians. But
yes.
Instead of to create wonder, they're creating laughs out of it. But Robin Hood, Wizard of Oz, Beauty and the Beast, It's a Wonderful Life. These are such artful, magical constructions using the artifice of cinema. And suddenly with Bicycle Thieves, you have a transcendent, evocative, magical film full of wonder and awe that uses real locations, real people, real life. It is possible to do that, and no other film, I think, introduces that concept better than Bicycle Thieves.
That's true. That is true.
So 1952, Singing in the Rain, we talked about. Would you agree with me that that may not be the best musical to introduce?
Just because of its plot line. But, you know, in terms of musical numbers, of talent and of, you know, dance sequences, and there's the all wordless one with the cloth and Gene Kelly, you know, where they're pitching an idea and then it just goes, well, you guys are the artist. Like, that to me is also a hilarious addendum dance number to a movie.
It seems odd though that we're going to have that and then again, but we're not giving you any of the greatness of the later part of the 20s and what silent films achieved. We're going to show you a film about how the advent of sound ruined everything, but we're not going to give you a film about how silent films perfected everything. It's an odd one to have in there. I
agree.
So 1953, Monsieur Hulot's Holiday.
Oh yes.
Okay.
Jacques Tati.
Now a famous Tati comedy. How is this perfect?
Well, it's perfect in that it is a sound film done by a silent film clown. And so you're transitioning the very thing you're arguing. In fact, I would always play Singing in the Rain and Mr. Hulot's Holiday back to back. Because one is about the transition of sound from silent to sound. And then here's one in the time of sound that most of its gags are silent. And it plays internationally because it is, while a French film, did even better in U.S. soils than I think it did in Europe, and shows how, you know, brilliant physical comedy is a universal language.
Well, and not only physical comedy, right?
There's sight gags.
But if we come out of, if comedy comes out of character, and we have affection and admiration, or even, hell, even if we dislike a character, we can laugh at them, right? But we can relate to the circumstances, and therefore it's funny. You know, again, we live in a time when comedy seems dead, and one of the reasons it's dead is because Hollywood believes that there's no international market for comedies, and yet so many of the most enduring icons of cinema internationally are comedy figures, and not just silent comedy figures. The Marx Brothers are recognized the world over.
Right. Though not as much as Chaplin and Mr. Irlo, Jacques Tati.
So
even Marcel Marceau for, you know, if you want to argue silent physical performance.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and we've talked about, I think the reason Jackie Chan became the biggest movie star in the world outside of America was not just because of the stunts, and maybe not mostly because of the stunts, and not just because of the action, or mostly because of the action, but I think at least as much because of the comedy. Because he truly was, again, this modern era silent comedian.
Totally.
Where the film, I guess what we're saying is that they're not silent films, and they're not even mostly silent films, but the comedy transcends any language barrier. And sometimes it transcends language itself.
Right. Yeah, because my favorite example of that is flying from Kuala Lumpur to Dhaka, Bangladesh, and the in-flight movie, because you had 56 different dialects, some, you know, perhaps of 200 people. There were maybe at least 40 languages spoken on that flight. The only in-flight movie that you could possibly watch was a silent Chaplin film, and to hear the airplane still erupting in laughter in the year 1997.
So next on the list is another head scratcher for me. The Night of the Hunter from 1955, a noir thriller directed by Charles Laughton, starring Robert Mitchum, Shelley Winters, and Lillian Gish, from a script by James Agee. I mean, this movie's hard-boiled. I'm not arguing that it's not culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant, as it was declared by the United States Library of Congress when they preserved it. And Cahiers du Cinéma in 2008 named it as the second best film of all time, behind Citizen Kane. I'm just curious, as is this the one that's appropriate for young people, a man of the cloth who is a serial killer.
Right.
I would argue certainly that there is no group in America that would have said, yes, this is an appropriate introduction to cinema for young people. Now, again, their relationship to church and Christianity in England is certainly different than it is here in 21st century America. But
But I also think if you got to introduce your kids to film noir, there's very few film noir that have kids in them. And this is one of the few, right? Because he stuffs the money in a rag doll, if I'm not mistaken, after a bank robbery where he kills a couple people. Isn't that this one? Yeah.
I just think it's so interesting that we probably are staying away. There is such sexual connotations to so much of film noir. Right? The psychological component, the expressionistic component, though I would say we've introduced it with Beauty and the Beast and Wizard of Oz and some of these other movies.
But they don't have the menace to it.
Oh, but like you said, there's menace in those. There's menace in Beauty and the Beast. There's menace in Wizard of Oz. And I just think it's odd that, yes, okay, Maltese Falcon would have overt sexuality to it. A Mitchum film that I would have first, which is Out of the Past, which is not only a great film noir, I would say every bit the equal of Night of the Hunter, is a seminal Robert Mitchum performance, but also has as one of its most important characters a teenager, and a teenager who is deaf.
That's right.
And it's a very heartwarming and heartbreaking portion of the story. He's the true confidant for Mitchum's character. So I would say that's more more appropriate for this list. And I have the real awful sneaking feeling that for the people who put this list together, introducing kids to serial killers, concepts of serial killers, is more appropriate than concepts of being led astray by sexual impulses. But I would argue at 14, maybe the conversation about sexual impulses ought to be one that is had.
Right. At 14, yeah, so if you put this at towards the end of that list, don't go in chronological order, but instead go in order of complexity.
But think about it. If you've got a 14-year-old or a 13-year-old, 12-year-old or whatever, and you want to do one movie a week, you're through this list in a year. Right, so
well, that's true.
I think it would be more appropriate than Night of the Hunter. All right, one of my favorites on this list. I can think of certainly again. This would be on the short list. If somebody said, "Give me 10 films that we should introduce the art of cinema to kids," I would certainly have 1955's Pather Panchali, the first of the so-called Apu trilogy by Satyajit Ray. I spoke about this film at length, I think, early in the year on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. What a wonderful film to introduce a foreign culture and a culture so foreign for so many children in the Western world, but also a culture that was so greatly affected by, obviously, British imperialism, which so it opens up that avenue of conversation between the adult and the educator and the young person watching it. And again, the universality of childhood everywhere in the world. It's a beautiful, beautiful film. And also, as with Bicycle Thieves, neorealist.
Yeah, I agree. However, I'm embarrassed to say this one missed my eyeballs. Up until now, I'm shocked. I've heard of it, of course, but my film studies, of course, were into Italian neorealism, and so I didn't get to my historic Bengali films till much later. So, on my list.
Well, now, what about the next one? Because I must admit that I've never seen this. It's a short film, a fantasy short film, from 1956, from France, called The Red Balloon. And I know people love this. This was a huge influence on people, but I have never seen this. And this strikes me as one that would have been an influence on a young, younger than 14, Dean Haglund.
Yes. Now, this one has such a great French feel to it. You know, almost the, you would use this to be the one, you know, in the 70s, however we said, we see a very ponderous French film. And here is a one that, because it is so simple, there's no dialogue in this. So you don't have to deal with reading or anything like that. It's just a large red balloon that the, young boy finds. And then it has a mind and a will of its own. And suddenly, this almost becomes a nicer version of the giant white ball in The Prisoner. I mean, it is so open to interpretation. It's such the beginning of a conversation that you can have to discover what kids are thinking, what anybody who's thinking, or what's going on in their mind when they watch this film. It's really quite, it's quite a joy to watch, and how, and it's a joy in its simplicity.
Well, talk about starting conversations. So many conversations would be started by Some Like It Hot, 1959. And I do think this is that, for that reason, if nothing else, is a great film to have on this list, because it's the perfect screen comedy, as I've said before. It's not only hilarious, there's music, and the music is good. It's thrilling when it wants to be thrilling. There's action in it. There's suspense. It's sad. It's poignant. It introduces the conversations of Prohibition, introduces the concept of gangster movies. We don't have any other gangster movies in here. It is kind of odd that, apropos of no Westerns, but here's Blazing Saddles. We're introducing the gangster form in Some Like It Hot, but the thing is it works as a gangster film. It really does. And I don't think the gangster genre is that fucking great that it needs to be. Even when you get into the Godfather movies, right? The Godfather was the best gangster movie ever made up until that point, and yet it's nowhere near the work of art as Godfather 2 is, which actually eschews the genre demands of the gangster movie. So I don't know if you need to introduce as an art form the gangster movie to kids, but if you do, why not Some Like It Hot? I do think this does, you know, inclusion in some of these movies begs questions of what you didn't include before. And there are entire jokes like Tony Curtis's Cary Grant impression that will now require some significant explaining, because you have no Cary Grant films on this list.
Right. How do you show the impersonation he's doing?
But
when there's nothing on here.
But how about issues of gender, issues of sexual equality, gender equality, issues of sexual preference. And all done in such a funny way.
Absolutely. And even the idea of comedy and drag. You know, Milton Berle, there was a tradition that a male comic dressing up as a female and putting on that persona. Flip Wilson's Geraldine, Milton Berle. And here you see it here, that just the sight gag of two guys wearing women's clothing would elicit guffaws of laughter in the theater.
On the shores that gave us Monty Python, of course, right. Some Like It Hot should be on this list. So I'm pleased to see that. But again, it makes it interesting to me that with all the sexual revelry and humor, that we're scared of it in seemingly these film noirs. That brings us to also in 1959, the film that started this whole conversation, when I had finally seen it this year and found this list. And that was Francois Truffaut's The 400 Blows.
Right. You only just saw it this year?
Well, I saw it this year on Blu-ray on Criterion. I'd seen it in film school. But I'd seen it because I was rewatching a bunch of Truffaut movies, and then just in researching it had come across this list. And indeed, The 400 Blows is kind of the whole reason you have this list. It's like, wow,
right,
this is the perfect movie to be showing a child, to be showing somebody coming of age who may be having trouble in school or at home. This is the perfect thing to make them feel not alone. To inspire their own creativity, to tell their own stories, to make it useful. This is the whole reason we have this list. Do we have 49 other films that belong on it? Right? I mean, that's almost like how you can hear that exercise beginning. A couple guys at the British Film Institute talking about how one of their kids is having trouble, and they showed them The 400 Blows, and it led to a wonderful conversation. Well, you know what we should do? We should compile a whole list of movies that would enable us to
Exactly. Dealing with all sorts of childhood issues.
Now,
it's true.
Another film that I don't believe that I have ever seen starts the 60s for us.
Okay.
And it is something called The Whistle, or Whistle Down the Wind. Do you know this film, Dean Haglund?
Yes, I do. Have I seen the whole thing? Was it great? It's a story of some country kids. They find a fugitive in their barn, and then he's mistaken as Jesus by the kids, who are heavily influenced, you know? So I don't know, have I ever caught the ending of it? because I know it has sort of all sorts of religious connotations, and it was fascinating and shot in a very, I thought, grainy, you know, kind of strange, almost disorienting kind of thing, because it was an allegory. It's some right. sort of a weird allegory of children's innocence and superstitious adults in the town and all that sort of thing. So I believe when I saw it, it either the allegory wasn't ringing for me, or I was so deeply disturbed because it rang too deeply, maybe. So well, I think I have to go back to this one.
Brian Forbes, it was his first film as director, and he would make several films that were quite disturbing, like The L-Shaped Room and The Stepford Wives. And
right.
So, and then he would become the head of EMI Films. In fact, I think he may have died not too long ago. And is that possible? I remember, anyway, within the last few years that we celebrated his life on in Celebrity Deaths, because he had...
Right, 2015.
Had quite a mark. Oh, yeah, so just a few years ago, but he had quite a mark as an yeah. actor and as a director, and then he became a studio head for a while there. So, you know, he was an important figure in the British film industry, and interesting enough, I now really want to see this, because... movies about kind of Christian and religious allegory were quite, I don't know if popular is the right word, but they were quite prevalent in British cinema in the early 60s. You think, obviously, Lawrence of Arabia.
Right.
This, what about Billy Budd, which is a film that I would have actually, a British yeah. film I would have had on this list. Billy Budd, based on the fantastic Herman Melville story, which is about, and I would say more resonant, more important in terms of its themes than Mutiny on the Bounty, right? Not that right. that made the list, but an important piece of literature and a very allegorical mm-hmm. piece of literature turned into a brilliant movie by writer-director Peter Ustinov, who also starred in it with young
right.
Terrence Stamp in a star-making role playing the Christ figure. I actually yeah. saw that in school in my formative years, where it was shown by my educators. So I take the British Film Institute to task for not having their very own Billy Budd on this list.
Billy Budd.
But maybe,
well, it's interesting.
Maybe
yeah.
because they selected this instead, and they were both from the same era, and like you're saying, they both travel some of the same ground, and this
yeah.
one has kids in it. So I'm actually looking forward to seeing this film now.
Yeah, I might go look at it again, too. After Beauty and the Beast. I'm going to start there, though.
So another film, this time from America, that deals with the thorny issue of race relations and mm-hmm. A treatise on our justice system and the importance of our justice system, and also a film that is told from the point of view of a child narrator. And it's
right.
1962's To Kill a Mockingbird.
Right. Now that, yeah, that again would have been... The reading, would that been required reading?
I'm sure.
By your time, you're 14?
Certainly yeah. in this country it would be, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, young Scout and Jem and Atticus, the father defending the black guy in the court in the small southern town. But it is really a coming-of-age tale of Scout, really, because it is told through her perspective and very much... relatable to any kid under the age of 14.
Yeah, and on here, because the publisher convinced the author to change it, and so the fact of the childlike narrator, the childhood narrator, being completely unreliable is not revealed in the book that actually got published, and it would not be revealed until the sequel is finally published. Just a couple of years ago, where we find out that Atticus Finch actually a Klansman. So, so yes, show this
so
by all
go.
Means
yeah.
to the kids under 14, so that they can ask what I asked, which is, how did Gregory Peck become a movie star? He can't act. But
come on, he's giving it the gravitas.
But then you grow up and you see some other movies, yeah, and you understand how he became a star. Never a great actor, but why he became a star. Movies like Guns of Navarone and The Gunfighter and all these. You get it. He is an idiomatic pillar of virtue in To Kill a Mockingbird. Just don't let any of those kids get their hands on the sequel. All right, now one that I'm sure is a big fun for you, and we talked about the fun and the idea of science fiction and fantasy films from the 1960s. Talk to me about 1963's Jason and the Argonauts. I feel like seeing this movie is in and of itself a rite of passage.
Absolutely. It's again, another stop-motion action Ray Harryhausen masterpiece. With not just the tale of the Cyclops, but also so many, the fighting skeletons. Good Lord, that kept me up for nights. Just armed skeletons with sabers. Good Lord, that'll put the bejesus into the kid. But yeah, Jason is, you know, it's the tale of Zeus and the ancient Greece and his mighty journey. And I think the Medusa fight's spectacular, particularly if you have already versed the kid through King Kong and explained stop motion animation. And then you see this and you think about how much work to individually place each snake on Medusa's head frame by frame so that she's battling and all the snakes are in it, being looking both natural as snakes and threatening as a wig. Good Lord, that's the sheer amount of work that Ray had to do.
Well, and you know, you hit upon right the mythology element. An important and a fun way to keep the mythology alive, and as hopefully these young people go on to read, you know, in a variety of genres and see movies in a variety of genres, they get the opportunity to see how so many of these themes, as well as the myths themselves, constantly get reinterpreted, reimagined, life gets breathed back into them from culture to culture, from continent to continent, from era to era, right?
It's true. Yeah, for sure.
So from Jason and the Argonauts in 63, we jump a few years to a movie that I have to admit that I have not seen, and I must lodge a formal complaint that we're already getting our second Jacques Tati film. We get one Chaplin, we get one Marx Brothers, we get you know, one noir, and it's later noir. We get no Westerns, no John Ford movies, no Orson Welles movies, obviously no Kubrick movies, but we get two Jacques Tati films, and it's Playtime 1967. I'm again, I think it's odd that they would use two for the same filmmaker when we're batting back and forth. Is this the one that you should choose for the Marx Brothers? Is this the one you should choose for Chaplin? But anyway, talk to me about this one, about Playtime, 1967.
Well, I agree. Is it his funniest? I mean, no. I thought Mon Uncle, my uncle, was funnier.
Oh, yeah, and that was one that we had to see in film school, but go ahead.
Yeah. And you saw that in film school because it had both the Jacques Tati classic silent creative stuff, but it also had good camera work. It was an all-around better film. This one, though, shot in 70 millimeter, so you know it's going to look great in your Criterion Collection DVD smack around. It's, you know, the giant set. Wasn't there, though, a lawsuit where a lot of these Jacques Tatis were withheld from being released? Or am I thinking of another filmmaker?
I don't know, but I do know. I mean, you know, again, he's playing Monsieur Hulot again. We get two Monsieur Hulots. We get, you know, we get the kid. That's the only chaplain we get. So I'm just saying, I've got.
I know.
I got a problem.
But this stylistically, I mean, enough, it's pretty though, modern.
Interestingly enough, though, co-written by American Art Buchwald. Isn't that an interesting aspect of playtime?
That is it. I didn't know that. That's pretty cool.
Okay. We then have a very interesting, almost like a British 400 blows. From kind of the British Truffaut, Ken Loach, who's still making movies today. We have a movie called Kes. And did you ever see this?
I don't think I have.
It's in the British Film Institute's list of the top 10 British films of all time. And
K-E-S.
Yeah, K-E-S. It's about a 15-year-old boy who has little hope. He's picked on, physically, verbally abused by his brother, or his half-brother, it might have been, or stepbrother or something, but also at school and his schoolmates. So he's bullied a lot, and the teachers are abusive. So it really is about an abused boy and who becomes a hopeless case, and yet his spirit is not crushed. By these things. And so it is a very affecting movie, but I've always remembered the ad campaign for it. They beat him, they deprived him, they ridiculed him, they broke his heart, but they couldn't break his spirit. Come on, kids, let's go see Kes. Anyway, so another 400 kind of blows-esque a film, really hardcore,
right.
and obviously something that was foremost in the consciousness of the British people at the time, which is corporal punishment in schools, right? You have the films that make Malcolm McDowell a star, If and Oh Lucky Man, that would not be suitable for young people, but this was something that probably could provoke very good conversations again, like 400 blows, between kids and their parents, and also kids and their educators. Being forced to watch this with kids might help make better parents and better teachers, I think.
Wow, fascinating. Okay.
So that's Kes 1969. Our final two that we'll get to today, and we'll do the second half of the list in another show.
Hooray!
Something called The Railway Children, 1970. Do you know this film?
No, this is a surprise to me, too. And this sounds actually kind of cool. It's another British drama, but it sounds almost pre-brain, not Train Stopper, Train Spotting, but it's like the Thomas the Engine, but live action. Almost.
Really? It's a spy movie, right? Isn't it an espionage movie? A period piece espionage movie? Okay.
Yeah, three kids, and they're all they're train passengers, if I'm reading that right. And again, I know nothing about this film.
Okay.
What do you know?
Well, I just know that, a man is guilty of espionage, and his family has to move as a result. And the kids befriend a mysterious man who frequents the train station, right? And they go looking for Dad and trying to piece together what happened to Dad. In some ways, it's a little bit kind of like a period adventure version of A Wrinkle in Time. Anyway, I do want to check it out. I mean, that actually sounds kind of fun. The movie starred, among others, one of the child performers was Jenny Agutter, who stars in the final film we'll talk about today, and which is a movie that I saw this year and talked about on the show and took you to task for not seeing, because it is one of the greatest films ever set in Australia, Nicholas Roeg's Walkabout.
Yes, this is a classic. And in fact, since you've talked about it, this is something people still do to this day, is the walkabout. You go and you walk the outback. And it is a spiritual journey, much like doing, a labyrinth in rocks. This apparently is laid out by 45,000 years of Aboriginal culture as a way to find both yourself and your spiritual self and survive in a desert wasteland that doesn't have much in the way of natural resources out there.
And the movie Walkabout, which starts off as harrowing and satirical as imaginable, where a father, a businessman, takes his kids out for a picnic in the outback, in the rural deserted outback, and he goes all kinds of nuts and tries to kill them before killing himself. They get away, the kids, and but good news, you're in the middle of nowhere in the outback, in the bush, and they cross paths with a young man who is on his ritual coming of age walkabout, and this indigenous young man helps them return to civilization, and in so doing, ruins his own life. And it is harrowing, and it has a lot to say about coming of age, and a lot to say about the natural order of things versus the order of man. That gets us halfway through the list, the British Film Institute list of the 50 films you should see by the age of 14. We will pick it up, who knows, maybe even on next week's show. Stay tuned.
Wow.
Yeah.
That'd be good.
Until then, I'm Phil Lernes.
I'm Dean Hagelin. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.